Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that influenced their own work in some small way. Today, I'm really excited to have writer-director Chaiko Amawale here. Hello.
Hi.
So for those of you who are less familiar with Chaiko's work, please let me give you an introduction. She grew up in seven countries while her father worked for UNICEF. It's a lot of traveling. Eventually, she made a home for herself in New York and graduated from Columbia University before going on to intern for Spike Lee and Mira Nair. While assisting directors George C. Wolfe and Tom Vaughn, she directed several short-form projects, including America's Shadows, HIV Risk for Black and Latino Youth. Her work tends to have a foundational message, I would say, which is why she was awarded the Gaia Sea Change Residency for artists working for social change. In 2012, she wrote the script for Solace, which would eventually become her feature debut. At that time, it was a semi-finalist for the Sundance Writers Lab. In 2015, the project became a recipient of the Panavision New Filmmakers Program. In 2016, it and Chaiko participated in Tribeca All Access, the IFP Narrative Lab, and the Creative Visions Creative Activist Program and Big Vision Empty Wallet Diversity Program. These are things with a lot of words in them. Okay, finally, in 2017, the Project of Solace was a Women in Film grantee and a Film Independent E-Film Company 3 grant winner. Solace then premiered, finally, at the LA Film Festival in 2018, winning special jury mention Best Ensemble Cast. The film is currently on the festival circuit and won New Orleans Film Festival Audience Award. Chaiko was a 2017 School of Making Thinking Resident Fellow, where she created the VR film Shapeshifters. In between her independent projects, she produces and directs commercials and branded content, and you can see her work at chaiko.com. So the movie that you chose to talk about today is a little bit fantasy, a little bit magic, a little bit musical, and coming of age, and it is called The Labyrinth. Can you tell us a little bit about why you chose that film to talk about?
I love David Bowie. He is my god. I still dream about him. And I watched that film when I was 8, and it has stuck with me since then. Like, mm-hmm. My ultimate dream is to be a filmmaker that can do epic fantasy films. So if I get to choose genre, I'm always going to choose something that has like a ton of magic in it, and David Bowie.
All right.
Yeah.
So for those of you who haven't seen The Labyrinth, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. My motto is always, it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you want to pause and watch The Labyrinth first, this is your chance. Okay, now let's introduce The Labyrinth. Let's see if I can get through this synopsis that I've got. Written by essentially a lot of people, but credited to Terry Jones, and directed by Jim Henson, The Labyrinth stars Jennifer Connelly as 15-year-old Sarah, a girl who's grown out of her old things but is still pretty damn mad when her brother, Baby, ends up with her teddy bear, Lancelot.
Someone has been in my room again! I hate that! I hate it!
In a moment of frustration, Sarah wishes her brother to be taken away by the Goblin King, Jareth, played by David Bowie, and her wishes his command.
You have 13 hours in which to solve the labyrinth before your baby brother becomes one of us forever.
An old puppet man named Hoggle then helps Sarah find the way into this labyrinth that she has to get through. She gets turned around by a worm almost immediately, but succeeds in defeating Jareth's first trap. She befriends a giant dog-ish kind of creature named Ludo. Hoggle then gets turned by Jareth and is supposed to give her a poison peach. In the meantime, Sarah's assaulted by some fire people who try to take off her head in play. Hoggle then saves her, and they're all transported to the Bog of Stench. There they meet Sir Didymus and his trusty steed Ambrosius. Hoggle then gives Sarah the poison peach, and she falls into a deep dream where Jareth confesses his love for her.
There's such a sad love deep in your eyes, a kind of pale jewel open and closed within your eyes. I'll place the sky within your eyes.
But Sarah manages to escape. Her new friends help her regain her memory, And then Hoggle redeems himself by getting them past the Goblin City Guard. Jareth sends an army, which is defeated by falling rocks. And then Sarah must chase after Jareth and Toby through an M.C. Escher castle, while Jareth tells her that he's moved heaven and earth for her and she should stay with him. She recites the lines from a play she was rehearsing earlier and finally remembers the last line.
You have no power over me.
And Sarah and Toby are returned to their home safe and sound. Missing her new friends, Sarah calls for them and they come and dance the night away. None of this makes sense, but it makes sense in its own way.
All to me, mm-hmm, yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like when I'm older, I realize I'm like, oh, yeah, this was definitely written by many people. Like, I didn't know it at the time, so I was just like, yeah, take me on this adventure. But when you get older, you're like, oh, no, this is kind of weirdly uncohesive, and it's fine. I really like it. You know?
Also, she's really kind of old for, like, the whole, like, fairy book thing and the way that she deals with it. But when you watch the film as an 8-year-old, like, anybody older than you, like, it all just makes sense.
Yes.
But when you're an adult, you're like, is she 14 or 15 and really, really angry and, like, believes that the Goblin King is going to come and get her baby brother? But I'm going to go with it anyway.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Like, 15-year-olds right now, they're, like, you know, trading hand job bracelets and stuff. It's very different.
Generational shifts.
But at the same time, you know, this is, I think it's something that we're definitely going to get into about the idea of kind of coming of age and sexuality too, because a lot of that was very purposeful in this movie. And I think that's something that really connected to people. Me? Others?
I wonder if there was because I was 8 and really in love with David Bowie. And when you go back and look at his costume, what is the male version of camel toe? His moose knuckle is so prominent. I think I was really into moose knuckles when I was younger.
Let me actually find a quote about this, because it's definitely purposeful. So there's actually something that Jim Henson had said before he passed. He said, "We're not looking at reality. We're inside this girl's head. There are references to all sorts of things in his costume. There's the danger of a leather boy in his leather jacket, which also has a reference to the armor of a certain type of German knight in it. There are references to Heathcliff from Wuthering Heights, and the tight trousers are a reference to ballet dancers. He's an amalgam of the inner fantasies of this girl. Everyone always talks about Bowie's perv pants, but there was a reason for it all. It has a surface that's fairly light, but then every so often you go, oh my God, how did we get away with that?" So that's the quote that I wanted to lead with.
I had never heard that before, but the ballet dancer thing, like, literally, I was obsessed with dance when I was a kid, and I also was obsessed with, like, male ballet dancers, because
yes.
I'd just call it their pouch.
Yes.
I just wanted to look at their pouch while they danced. And I think it's interesting that, like, folks assume young kids don't have any sort of, like, sexual inclinations, but, like, we do, like, little girls do. And
Yeah, it develops pretty early on what you're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
But I love the fact that, you know, that's the thing,
the
that
leather.
they were aware, and they presented this costume to Bowie, and he was just like, yeah.
Of course, because it's Bowie. I always think about, like, who is our Bowie now? Like, who is a musician that also is, like, in film, but then is, like, a completely, like, eccentric character and, like, completely in art? And the closest person that I can think of is Janelle Monáe. It doesn't feel quite the same because of, I think Bowie was doing a lot with, like, gender and androgyny and, you know, but that's the person that I can think of. That's the closest that we have. But Bowie was really, like, he was my god.
You do have a certain amount of kind of, like, gender nonconformation in your film, I would say. Like, there's, you know,
Gadado, the next door, one of the next door neighbors.
Yeah.
Yeah. He, you know, it's so interesting because when you take a long time to make a film, which is I shot the film in 2015 and then premiered it in 2018, and I started writing in 2012. That was like, for me, I was really interested in fluidity. Like mm-hmm. that was my vocabulary. I didn't have the vocabulary at the time for like gender nonconforming, but really I just wanted these kids to have a sense of like freedom where Gadotto didn't need a name, didn't need an identity, you know, didn't need a mm-hmm. category of like, I'm bi, you know, we didn't want to call him bisexual. We didn't want to say fluid. We just wanted it to just be.
Yeah.
And I think that for me is like ultimate freedom, which is where I want to be in the future.
And we should back up that Solace is about a young woman named Sol who has some psychological issues that she's trying to deal with, a lot of food issues specifically, and issues around her dead mother and her, you know, her past father. And she's trying to come to terms with the fact that she's been pushed to live in Los Angeles with people that she doesn't even know when she meets these wonderful weirdos next door who open up a new kind of avenue of her life. And that's, you know, that's all coming of age stuff.
It's,
you know, it's I can see that in both your movie and obviously it's so present in The Labyrinth. But I, you know, in the 80s, just the fact that like a kid's movie would have this character who is, you know, a fluid sexual being who, you know, like that's mm-hmm. fascinating to me. Like how did and I heard that like the choice was between Michael Jackson and David Bowie.
Oh my God. That just put a whole other spin on it just because of the new documentary that's coming out about Michael Jackson.
I know.
I feel much better about the choice of David Bowie.
Yeah.
It's so interesting. That Michael Jackson thing just spun me for a loop. Yeah. But yeah, David Bowie, I mean, I think also like when you're a young girl, you're not, at least in the 80s, like you don't, there's not really any terminology for gay or queer. I'm sure all the adults knew that like David Bowie was fluid, but like I think a lot of girls like men that look kind of feminine a lot of the time and pretty, and the idea, I know that when I was younger I wanted to escape, like that was like my primary thing, like I just want to be somewhere else, escape into stories, into myth, like whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea of like being in love and obsessed with a king, like I'm not thinking goblin like ugly, but I'm thinking goblin king, like this magical handsome man that can like whisk you away, like that I think is what my little like 8-year-old brain was like so drawn to for Labyrinth.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't really know. I didn't know why at that time, that's for sure. And also, Jennifer Connelly was a beautiful young girl. Mm-hmm. She was like so pretty, and I was just like, oh, I want to be like her. Can my eyebrows be like hers, you know? Oh, I was like, I want to be on this adventure. I was very jealous of her. I wanted to talk about kind of the impetus to make this movie, because mm-hmm. Dark Crystal was the movie that this team had made before.
Yes.
It did not do very well. And they had put their heart and souls into it. And so The Labyrinth was kind of their way to be like fixing the problems that they thought were in Dark Crystal, that, you know, to get more access to the audience, which was doing what they did for the Muppets and the Muppet Show, making sure that there were human characters interacting with the puppet characters. Mm-hmm. And so they were like, oh, well, maybe people just couldn't latch onto a face or something. So they were like, okay, so we'll get this big star, we'll get a girl, and we'll have some humans in the story.
And there's also more music. Like mm-hmm. Dark Crystal was a lot, I like to talk about like the shadow, like Dark Crystal lived in more of the shadow realm than Labyrinth. Like I noticed when I was rewatching Labyrinth, it's like as a kid, there's certain things that might look scary, but it's totally like it just gets light because the way the Muppets are even like colorful balls of like, I don't know, fur and cloth, as opposed to in Dark Crystal, they look really spooky.
Yes.
In Dark Crystal, there's like song and dance in Labyrinth. Like you don't have any of that in Dark Crystal. And yeah.
And that was all purposeful because they were like, I don't know, people like music. That's like their whole thing. They were like, we're really going to try to make people like this movie. Of course, this was also a flop. So they were like, what do we have to do? Home video was, you know, better for them. But the designer, you know, the character designer is the same person. And I never remember how to pronounce his last name.
Is it Froud?
Is it Froud or Frood?
I've been saying Froud all my life.
Let's
I don't
just
know
say
if
Brian
I'm
Froud because you're on the show and Chico's rules. Okay,
so I am queen.
When it's one of those things where the way that the script kind of came together was because of Brian Froud's designs. And, you know, he would just kind of sketch these characters from different angles. And he had a huge book and he would just give it over to Terry Jones. Mm-hmm. And Terry Jones would be like, oh, I like this one. Or he'd like come up with a character and he wanted a personality. So he'd flip through this huge book and be like, that one, that's the character,
amazing.
That's the personality. So Terry Jones said, quote, in some way, Labyrinth was Brian Froud's project. I think he came up with the idea of doing something about a labyrinth. Whenever I got to a situation where I wanted to invent a character, I would flip through his creations until I came to one that I liked and give it words. I was collaborating in a funny way with Brian Froud because I was springing off his drawings.
So I just like that would be so cool to work like that.
Right?
Like I would love, love, love that. Like, I'm writing something now. I know this is, like, off topic of Solace, but I'm writing something now that's, like, a fantasy film about fairies. Because also, Brian Froud has, like, a huge book about fairies.
Mm-hmm.
Mine won't look like his. But as I'm, like, writing and trying to, like, build the world, I'm like, oh, this would be – like, I'm a kind of director that loves collaborating. I'm not – even though on Solace I have writer, producer, and director credit, like, the way that I prefer to work is really like with a ton of brilliant individuals. And then like, because to me, filmmaking or directing is like this, it's like alchemy, right? Like you're the person that puts this and that together. And then you come out with this beautiful thing. And yeah, that just sounds like such a cool process.
I mean, it is the matter of like, have you ever, you know, just found someone's art? Like, because there is quite a bit of, you know, an idea of modern or contemporary art and performance art in Solace. I mean, are you looking at other people's art and being like, oh, okay, what can I do from this? Like, what can I take from these images?
For Solace or for my fairy film?
Either.
You know, it's kind of, it's different for both. Like with Solace, again, because it took so long, like I really was kind of fired up by Pussy Riot and the idea of being like really, really rebellious and kind of like burning things down and just like kind of sticking your middle finger up. And then I think when I was in the edit, either when I was in the edit or maybe right before prep, like that's when I started to like see photos of like women, I think from Black Lives Matter. Like there's a photo that's in the film of like a bunch of black women who are topless and just protesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then I start to get really interested. Well, I've always been interested in the body because I feel like my work is about magic and self-destruction. And it's always trying to answer this question of what does a liberated black body look like?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think probably what I was doing, because it's been so long, while I was prepping was just combing through Instagram and combing through like various different sort of like political activist artists. And with the budget we had, with the time we had, this is kind of what it came to be in Solace. I think it probably would have been a lot different had my financial situation with my film been a little bit more different. But yeah, for the fairy film, Instagram is helpful because there's this one account that like features black characters that are fantastical. And so that's kind of like the place where I can see things. But I'm actually trying to get most of my inspiration from watching nature videos. Like, you know, those documentaries about like the ocean and like, because there's so many cool animals in the sea and trees and sky that you can like borrow little things from. And for me, I'm like constantly trying to figure out how I can ground myself in a more African-centered sort of aesthetic world. And there's this indigenous community called the Dagra. I don't know if you say tribe or community, but they're called the Dagra people, and they believe in magic and very much in the unseen world. And nature is like super important to them. And so I think when I'm getting into the more detailed stages of writing my fairy story, I'm probably going to be more inspired from nature than like what a human has drawn.
I think if you actually look at the Jim Henson's thought process when he was going through this, he had all these kind of fantastic characters that Froud was drawing.
Mm.
But he, you know, when he visited Froud in England, he roamed the countryside, saw all of this, like the rocks and the trees and the
little
grass
mushrooms
there.
As well.
And he was just like, no, this is what I want. I want this earthiness. And he was really adamant about having real earth and a real grounding tone into the the body of the design mm-hmm. and the body of the story, because he felt like that's something that someone could connect to. And so he, you know, he just wandered around England for a while, the countryside, and, you know, found these areas that he wanted to mimic in the design.
I love it.
So,
I love it.
You know, all great directors.
Yes.
We're just going to take one quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, the evolution of this story of the labyrinth and how the final draft actually came to be. One quick break.
Unless you binge watch TV at least 80 hours a week, Inside Pop is definitely not for you.
Sean, that's a little extreme and also not quite true.
Okay, Amita, how about Inside Pop is the podcast for people who love and appreciate the best pop culture has to offer?
Oh, much better.
In every episode, we interview the people who create the culture you crave.
Past interviews include the showrunner of Ava DuVernay's Queen Sugar and Mudbound director Dee Reese.
You'll also get the very best pop culture recommendations in our Big Sell segment.
Plus the opinions of two TV producers who are pop culture obsessives and actually do binge 80 hours of TV a week.
Eyeballs. So tired.
Listen to Inside Pop every other Wednesday on the Maximum Fun Podcast Network.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Chaiko Amawale, and we are talking about The Labyrinth.
The Labyrinth.
Okay, so something that I thought was really interesting was the original drafts that, you know, Terry Jones had done. And this is before Elaine May had done a draft on it, too. You know, so many people did drafts on
this. Did she get credited? Because I remember when I was watching, I only saw Terry's name.
No, he didn't want to work on it anymore. And so Jim Henson offered him full credit if he would work on it one last time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it was like a really, really long process.
God.
But one of the major changes that they had in, you know, the drafts was the fact that the Goblin King was someone who was completely separate, and you didn't see him really until like the end. You know, like she was kind of kept separate from him, and, you know, she would eventually find him. But the thing is, they were like, it's David Bowie, and
we need some sexual tension at the very beginning of the film.
Yeah.
Danger.
Yeah.
And also male camel toe.
Yes. And some music.
Right.
Like, where the fuck are the songs going to be? Which reminded me, do you think that we could do a back and forth of You Remind Me of the Babe?
What babe?
The Babe with the Power.
What power? I'm like, that
the power of voodoo.
Hoodoo.
What?
Doo-doo.
You do.
I saw my baby dying. I never remember words to songs, so I have no idea if I'm even singing the right lyrics.
But it's a great song, and I'm glad that they changed things so that they could have some, you know, some more music in Bowie throughout
right.
the film.
I miss him so much.
I know. He's never going to be the same. But I really enjoy how he's woven in, even if it doesn't always make sense,
right.
you know? And I love that he's got, like, his weird, you know, at the center of the labyrinth, there's just all of his goblins around him. And they're wonderful. And
you forgot the crystal ball.
The crystal ball. And, of course, like, his staff was made to look like a microphone.
Oh, you know, I never saw that. I never noticed that when I was rewatching.
Yeah, it's an interesting little detail. But they, you know, like the design people put a lot of cool signifiers
in there.
And, you know, we'll talk about some of the other ones that are in the movie too. But I really enjoyed the idea that this movie went through many hands. Like the script went through many hands, and it was just kind of a mess. Like by the time that it got back to Terry Jones the last time, Jim Henson was like, okay, so we changed it all, and now it's not funny, so you need to make it funny again. And then that's what happened, was Terry Jones kind of coming to set, like even up until like the day that they were shooting, and he would kind of look at what they had made and be like, oh oh, I've got a joke for this. And so he would scribble out these jokes and, you know, punch up the script even as they were making
it.
Wow. And I thought that that was a really interesting process, especially for this movie that has so much production design to it. You know, like they're still kind of freewheeling. They're like, we've got the characters. We can kind of move around with the dialogue because mm-hmm. they're agile. These performers have been doing this for a long time.
But like I thought that was fantastic. Thinking of the worm in my head.
Oh, the worm.
The worm. You know, the thing that's really encouraging about like you sort of like relaying the story of how it all came to be, that the movie was a flop, but you ask anybody who likes The Labyrinth, like we are die hard fans for this film. And as a director who is emerging and starting out, it's like, oh, your film doesn't have to be perfect for it to actually have the effect that mm-hmm. I think most filmmakers want to have on an audience, which is a love and an attachment to the world and to the characters. And it's like, I will fight anybody that will tell me that Labyrinth is not a good movie because I don't care about the inconsistencies. I don't care about anything. That movie makes me so happy when I watch, and I'm almost 41, just as happy as when I was 8. Like, if you're a filmmaker making a film, what more do you want than for people to like love your like this art that you've made so much that it carries from 8 to 41? Like,
yeah,
that's amazing.
And that's something, you know, something that I think about when I review films as well, is the fact that I enjoy imperfect movies.
Mm-hmm.
As long as like the rest of it is just, you know, saying something and has, you know, some kind of emotion
yes.
that connects with me, I am more than happy to overlook imperfections and even maybe embrace them and enjoy mm-hmm. them because they feel human.
Yeah, that's actually that word. When I was on set and when I was talking to everybody that would come on board to Solace, I was like, this film is about imperfection. Like, it's about the process and we're going to embrace imperfection. But the thing that I want people to feel when they watch my film is that they have a sense of who I am, what I'm trying to say, mm-hmm. and that there's some residue of my cinematic world left inside of someone's soul. And so I don't care if there's like, you know, some narrative structures that are like off. Like, I'm so much more interested in heart and in soul.
I would love to switch a little bit and talk about the idea of, you know, we talked about Dark Crystal earlier and kind of the differences between this and that.
Mm-hmm.
The puppets here in The Labyrinth are very realistic.
Uh-huh.
And that's why they actually went with George Lucas as an executive producer, because they could work with him and all of his people to make realistic looking. And, you know, mm-hmm. like when we're talking like realistic, like we mean like that there's, you know, specific kind of facial movements.
Of like
and, you
a
know,
little, yeah, I'm like showing you, but I should be
I know,
saying
I'm
what I'm
too.
Doing.
Like you can tell that they could be of this world
mm-hmm.
As opposed to kind of like floppy, moppy kind
right.
of Muppets, that kind of thing. And so this is a very different process, and the number of characters that they had designed is kind of intense. But, you know, George Lucas was the reason why they were able to pull it off
so
at all.
Cool. So cool. I mean, I think it's really interesting to think about in the 80s and then where we are now because of technology. You know, like, I don't think anybody is making a Del Toro, I believe, in Shape of Water. The creature felt more real because of how he wanted to design that creature.
Mm-hmm.
But I think generally because of CGI, like, I don't know. There's something that maybe because I'm old and it's nostalgia, but there's something super cool about like a tangible art form
yes.
in fantasy, you know? And it's also really interesting. I just always, I'm trying to compare like the 80s to where we are now, like the sort of conservatism that I remember growing up in the 80s with like what's happening now again mm-hmm. around the world. And I really feel like we're actually about to enter another age in filmmaking where fantasy, not just like the Marvel like sci-fi stuff, but like magic and mm-hmm. dragons and fairies and creatures. Like I feel like we're going to get more of that. And
yeah.
I just think it's an interesting thing to then look at the craft of fantasy filmmaking. Like, obviously, it's going to look different, but I don't know. I just like to think about it. Like, there's something beautiful about puppetry and about, like, the physicality of the person who is I'm like again showing you with my body instead of talking about it. But
I think
yeah.
it's going to come back. There are so many young filmmakers, and by young I mean like maybe under 50.
Mm-hmm. Like, am I still young then?
Who remember what filmmaking was like? And you know, you've got movies like Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, which mm-hmm. is coming out. Del Toro produced, and it has a lot of practical monster costumes.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something that we're going to be looking at a lot. But the issue is, though, that there's also not there aren't that many people who can create these costumes, who can create these monsters yeah. and these puppets. And that's something that, you know, like we don't really have like the kind of support for that that maybe we did before
right.
when, you know, practical stuff was the industry standard.
Mm-hmm.
So even back then, they were, you know, they were like, how do we do it? I think, what is it? George Lucas said, how can we make these look like real creatures? It's a struggle because it's a technological exercise more than anything else. Jim's ability to combine old puppet techniques with state-of-the-art was his genius. He really understood how to make believe and then make it real. So there's the extra added layer of having someone who knows how to use the practical
yeah.
effects. And
like technology.
Yeah. And yeah. that's something that he was able to do. We've talked about on this show Jurassic Park and the fact that the practical dinosaurs that they had, they brought in puppeteers to teach people how to move and to teach.
It's a craft.
Yeah. And the puppeteers came in and taught the CGI people how body
cool.
movement, because they were like, they've studied it so much. And so they were teaching that. So there's a way to meld those things, but uh-huh. I don't know that we're doing it.
You know
right
what
now.
You're making me think of is Andy, is it Serkis? Andy?
Yeah.
Yeah. That there is a craft in what he's doing, even though, you know, he's playing like Gollum. I mean, Gollum's not CGI, but I know there's a lot of technical things involved with like creating a Gollum character or creating any mm-hmm. of the characters that he plays.
Yeah, all the motion capture
yes,
stuff
that
he's doing.
Yes, that's it, motion capture. But that's actually really hard to, like what he's doing is a total craft. And he's really, really amazing at it. And I wonder, I don't know, are there going to be like more people training to be like him so that this sort of new form of fantasy with creatures and motion capture, you know, it's not mm-hmm. just like a, I don't want to say a flat CGI painting, but just something that has more, I guess, humanity in it because of the physicality of
yeah.
somebody playing it. Like, I don't know, it just made me think of that.
And, well, I mean, speaking about working with actors, I would really love to bring up how David Bowie was on set in this movie, because apparently they fucking loved him.
Oh, yes.
I think they said, yeah, he's really down to earth. But then in the film, he loved making just bold and weird choices. This is Jim Henson's
yes.
Son, Brian Henson, talking. And my dad loved it. They would laugh a lot together. My dad always enjoyed people he could laugh a lot with. And David always had these fun little twists that he wanted to put into every moment that he was on screen. They really had a ball working together. So that's an, I mean, it's a really beautiful thing. You have a performance artist, you know, because mm-hmm. David Bowie's not just like a singer or
exactly.
a musician. You know, he's a performance artist. And so that means that he's finding new ways to try to represent himself.
Yes.
And boldly,
too.
Yes.
Like, that's the thing that I think is most exciting for me as a director, is to be able to work with people who want to, like, go hella far.
Yeah.
Like, go super far so that we can bring it back, but at least go far so we know what we can, like, what we can play with.
But, I mean, how do you find those kinds of actors? Because I do feel like that's a little bit rare. I mean, it would be lovely if everyone was just all in all the time, but
yeah.
that's a lot to ask of people, too.
You know, I like to try and start from my idealistic, like, wish list. I mean, right now what I'm doing is I have a friend, a young friend, Amen, who I completely adore. And Amen I met through Hope Olaide, who's the star of Solace, because they were on a TV show called The Last Ship together. And see, this is why I'm not a great Hollywood person. But Amen played a role that was, in my heart, just breaks my heart. He's like he's a football player stature black man
mm-hmm.
who played this character called Bacon on The Last Ship, this TV show. And all the, like, a lot of the things that he's done for TV really reduces him to just a big black man.
Mm-hmm.
Yet this man, this actor, has studied in Russia, like, can dance, and like part of the training that he did in Russia was a lot of physicality, like,
oh, okay.
they, you know, like, he is so talented and has barely gotten anything interesting to do in Hollywood, because we know why, but being friends with Amen, I get to meet other actors who he's like, oh, yeah, you should meet that person from Juilliard. You should meet that person that went to Harvard with me. You should meet that person that went to Yale. And like he sort of, I guess through like my friend network, I'm finding actors who enjoy and are as titillated as I am by the idea of like craft mm-hmm. and like working at their craft.
It's hard. It's hard to find.
Yeah, you know, I'm not a complete working director yet in Hollywood. So this is all just like my ideal of like what I would love to be able to like continue to do.
Well, there's a it's coming. It's coming.
It's coming.
It's coming. So we're gonna take another quick break and we'll be right back.
There's nothing quite like sailing in the calm international waters on my ship, the SS Biopic.
Avast! It's actually pronounced biopic.
No, you dingus! It's biopic!
Who the hell says that? It's biopic.
It's the word for biography and picture.
All right, that is enough. Ahoy, I'm Dave Holmes. I'm the host of the newly rebooted podcast, formerly known as International Waters. Designed to resolve petty but persistent arguments like this. How? By pitting two teams of opinionated comedians against each other with trivia and improv games, of course. Winner takes home the right to be right.
What podcast be this?
It's called Troubled Waters, where we disagree to disagree!
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Chaiko Amawale. Hello.
Hola.
We are talking about The Labyrinth. I would like to get into Sarah's character a little bit. Is that okay?
Yes.
We talk about Sarah's character. So I think that this is an interesting kind of interpretation, but the way that they kind of wrote Jareth is that Jareth is a part of Sarah, mm-hmm. that they are like the same character, but they're not, but they're the same.
but they're not.
But they're not.
But they're the same.
Bowie characterized his character as a spoiled child, vain and temperamental, kind of like a rock star. Uh-huh. He was fine poking fun at himself because, you know, he was essentially playing a kind of version of himself mm-hmm. as projected on, you know, from a girl's kind of wanting and desire of him. And so it's an interesting thing about his character kind of being cobbled together from Sarah's adolescent
fantasies.
Dreams and fantasies. You know, he's merely a projection. And I think Jim Henson said, "We're not looking at reality. We're inside this girl's head." There are references to all sorts of things in his costume. There's the danger. Oh, sorry, we already got into that. But the idea is that essentially there's parts of her in him, and that is a very dangerous thing to write, especially when it comes to like sexuality, because it's like, how are your people going to perceive this?
I'm like, want to think about that. There's parts of her in him. Well, what is the danger? I'm going to flip the question back on you, because I think it could be actually interesting to think about if, like, I don't know, just in 2019, thinking about gender, that there is masculine and there is feminine mm-hmm. in all of us. And yeah. so then maybe there doesn't need to be such a danger in a, you know, projecting a young woman's sexuality within somebody who is, I don't know, a cisgendered man.
A cisgendered 40-year-old man.
Right, right. But that is the weird thing about when you watch it when you're older, which, you know, as women, when you get past a certain age, I think you start noticing, all these movies always have a hella older dude with like a much, much younger woman. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, from an adult point of view, it's, yes, his desire of her, she's a teenager and he's clearly like, you know, way over 18.
Yeah, Bowie said that it was like she's pretty strong-willed, pure, and psychologically, I guess, the Virgin Mary figure that some guys seem to yearn for.
Yeah.
I know, right? I mean, he seemed to be like, I don't really care about that. Uh-huh. But, you know, like that's, you know, what this character is interested in. Like, oh, this pure girl, you know, like, mm-hmm. please just come and be with me, you
yeah,
child.
I'm not so into that. And I don't think I was ever into that part, like, when I was younger. There was always a sense that I had of, like, not really liking the, like, pressure of having to be pure.
Yeah.
Even without, you know, at 8, 9, 10, 12, without even understanding all the sort of complexities of, like, the world and, you know, sexism. I think, because I think it's really actually interesting to think about your impulse when you watch something. And so I'm thinking about the little girl inside of me. So even though I'm 41, I'm still watching it to kind of like relive like my inner child.
Yeah, that's imprinted generally in your memory, too.
Exactly.
Like you can't not watch it through that lens.
Right. But I also think as adults, it's good for us to sometimes play and to also go back to our inner child.
Yeah.
And in that way, like, even when I'm watching it, like, I kind of put aside some of the weird things that I'm seeing and hearing also, because also some of the goblins like have quote unquote like black accents, and you know, and some of the like I think in fantasy is so colonized in that, you know, even when an American is making a fantasy film, it's like the magical people all have to have a British accent. Mm-hmm. So again, there's also this like hierarchy of like talking hierarchy of accents, and as somebody who grew up around the world, it's just, it's interesting, you know, I've always sort of spotted those details of like artistic choices people decide to make. Mm-hmm. But when I'm watching it from like my inner child self, like I'm not, I think I'm just most excited by magic. I'm most excited by like the centralized, I think just the centralizing of being this girl who's like, fuck everything, I want to go do this. And then, mm-hmm. and then going out and doing it. And then also still having a sense of like, I guess, responsibility, because she does go and save her baby brother instead of just getting lost in the magic. Like, that's all the stuff that I focus on mostly when I'm watching it.
Yeah.
From my inner little girl.
I mean, you were talking about magic and self-destruction earlier, and I think that this is kind of a prime example of mm-hmm. that type of thing. Something that really struck me was that, so, you know, Jareth, he's this older man searching for his Virgin Mary, and but Sarah develops the strength to turn him down is the thing. And it's a really interesting thing. Usually when you have these stories about like young girls kind of coming into their own sexuality with like older men, it's just like they feel like tempted, you know, mm-hmm. and they like they take the bait because they're like they feel like they want to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
But something that's beautiful about this is that she finds her own maturity, but it doesn't actually have to do with sex,
right?
And then like that sex is kind of like the red herring of maturity. And and then she actually can find it by being, you know, like a person who cares about someone else,
mm-hmm.
and you know, who's not insular and who, you know, wants to save her baby brother.
Yeah.
And to me, I think that that's a really interesting kind of developmental maturity that we see in a female character who's so young that I just don't think that we often see.
Yeah.
It could have taken a darker turn.
Yeah. Yeah. How old do you think she was?
She was 15.
God, that's so old in today's time. But
yeah.
She really was acting like...
And she was 14 when she filmed it, but it was... The character was 15.
So interesting. I mean, you know, we were saying on the break, or I was saying on the break, how I'm so drawn to darkness.
Yeah.
Like, I probably... If I were, like, I probably would want to do something if I were making this kind of film where it's not that sex is a red herring, but her personal sexual empowerment would be a power.
Yeah.
And that would be independent of an external body, independent of a man.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't, you know, I'm really interested in our future being a place where teenagers' sexuality is normalized,
mm-hmm.
and not pathologized, and also I always think of things in bubbles. Yeah, like where like teenagers and kids can develop sexually in a safe bubble, like without an adult penetrating it and doing anything disgusting. And and so I think that would actually be a really amazing thing to be able to pull off, is if you had a teenage character like that where sex isn't bad, but sex isn't about the man or somebody else.
Yeah. I think there's a way to interpret the story in those means,
because
she does reject him, but she doesn't reject herself.
Mm-hmm. Is the dream kind of like, because she falls into a deep sleep, which is also kind of creepy when you think about, it's just like interesting how depending on the time of human history, like right now, because there's so much in our like discourse in society around, you know, sexual assault and harassment and like, you know, drugging women,
mm-hmm.
like that she gets put to sleep and then in her dream, because it's not really a dream, she's kind of like past something that she's then like knocked out, and then she starts to have these like sort of sexual fantasies with, you know, Jareth.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of creepy.
It's all creepy. I mean, you wanted to get into dark shit. Yeah, we're getting into dark shit.
I'm into it.
One of the things that I mentioned earlier that I wanted to get back to was the kind of secret shapes and things that they put into the puppets. Freud said, we're dealing with metaphor here. So all the characters had designs in them, shapes and forms and ideas that give the film a depth that only emerges over the years. The great thing about puppets is that they do nothing. They actually do very, very little. And so the trick is, for me, when I was designing things in Labyrinth, is to define creatures that whatever they do it really well. So you imagine it's doing a lot more than it really is. All the shapes and the forms are telling their own story. They're giving you information about the character and what it's doing, what it parses in the world that I designed.
I love it.
And I looked at some of his characters, right? I looked at Ludo and I looked at the old man and the way that he's got shapes on their faces, you know, because we have these kind of primal understandings of like a triangle evokes this emotion, you know, like so, you know, a face that's shaped this way will evoke this kind of thing. And so he's doing these kinds of shortcuts, you know, of like, this is what this character is. And so it's, I mean, this is deep psychological stuff.
I think, you know, when I was watching it, I was like, it's so interesting because the focus in terms of what the camera is doing, the camera isn't doing a lot of like sweeping movements and panning. And it's like really the focus is on the design, right? Like it's on the production design. It's on the puppets. It's on the costumes. And it's not the camera is sort of the camera's sort of just like our gateway into seeing this world as opposed to being the gateway into our emotions.
Yes.
And a lot, I think modern fantasy, I think because of technology and the ability to like have sweeping camera movements and still have your other world look real, like it's a different kind of filmmaking. But yeah, I'm like picturing Ludo in my mind, the big stuffed animal looking huge puppet.
Yeah.
That's like cute.
Yes.
He's huge. Like at first she was like afraid of him or like afraid of the noise. And then when she saw him, it was like, he's so cute and he's so adorable.
Yeah. Even though he's giant, he's still this kind of friendly type of face.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, that's other level kinds of design that we're talking about.
And I think doesn't he kind of look like, what is that book, Where the Wild Things?
Well, Maury Sendak, I think, is the person that we're talking about. And actually, Maury Sendak knew Jim Henson and knew his ex-wife.
Oh, wow.
And there was kind of an issue between them because he felt that maybe the fire people specifically and some other folks had been kind of taken from his work. Freud, the designer, said, look, we're all just working off of the old European fairy tales.
Right.
Like, all of us are using those as a basis. But, you know, so
yeah.
It does seem a little bit like Sendak's work.
It did. Because also in the beginning of the film, which I only realized like much later on, in her room before she's in the fantasy world, everything that shows up in the labyrinth world, they're pictures and images in the set dressing of her room.
Yes.
And so I saw a picture, like when I was rewatching, I saw like a sketch or something that looked like a Ludo character and also looked like Sendak's character.
Yes. Yeah. It's very interesting. Sometimes people steal with things and they just don't know. It's just like in the consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm curious about your work. I mean, we're talking about design. Did you put any kind of like secret designs in your stuff?
No. I did, but not like fantastical. There were, so because of the artwork that Sol is doing, which is kind of like not real art. She's kind of getting she's making collages. Like I put in, for people who would know, like in one of the collages that she makes, there's Walter Rodney, who was a Pan-Africanist that wrote a book called How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. Like I have a picture of him in there. I have like a picture of Miriam Makeba in one of the like websites that she's at. Like I plugged in little things that are very specific to my history, like Chaiko. I speak about myself in the third person. Chaiko's growing up, like being somebody from the Caribbean. My father worked with Walter Rodney. They were both in the Working People's Party in Guyana. So I put all those little things in because this film for me wasn't, even though it's not my particular story, like it was very important for me to put myself in there. And so I part of my eating disorder history in the film, I didn't get to say before, but my film is inspired by me, you know, being a Black woman who didn't realize she had an eating disorder until mm-hmm. she was 30, because the image of somebody with an eating disorder is like a skinny, white, rich girl.
Yeah.
And
really, the only image I saw of a Black woman with an eating disorder is in the TLC video for fucking Waterfalls. And
oh,
that
my
was
God, I totally
it.
Forgot that.
Yeah.
What was somebody throwing up, or what
yeah,
was
she
the
was, she was compulsive eating and bulimic.
Oh, my God. I have to rewatch that. That is so cool.
But yeah,
I mean, not cool that the person had an eating disorder. But, like, you know, it's important for these images to just be dropped, but I clearly wasn't aware because I just didn't even know that I had a problem. But you know, growing up the way I did, my dad worked for UNICEF. And so I, you know, a lot of the countries I grew up in, there was just, like, a lot of craziness happening. Like,
yeah,
you're in school in Freetown and all of a sudden soldiers are running down the streets with AK-47 because there's a coup. Or you're in Sana'a and you're about to wake up to, you know, go choreograph for the Aladdin play at your high school, but then they're dropping bombs. And so for me growing up, like, my escape from kind of the chaos of all the different countries that I lived in and the sort of just, like, intense mobility that my family life had mm-hmm. was to escape into all kinds of different fantastical worlds. And so in Solace, I just was kind of like putting nods to, like, my own history, you know,
yeah.
sort of like to, like, my little Chico of, like, you know, Walter Rodney, Mary McCabe, like, things about, you know, various African countries that were going through the independent struggles, because that's where I came from, like, with my parents. And
yeah.
that's sort of part of the trauma that I've inherited, which then I decided to, you know, run away with by just binging.
But those details add an authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
That something, you know, it is you know, what Freud's talking about, too. We're not talking about Freud the psychologist.
Oh, Freud.
Yeah. What Freud is talking about is, you know, this kind of hidden psychological thing that you can do with design, with movies, you know,
it.
Where it just kind of, like, tips the audience off onto thinking.
So many things. The sound design, I did a lot of that, where I tried to, we try to, like, in the beginning of the film, I've also inserted myself into the film as a way of kind of disrupting and also critiquing Hollywood and also putting my stamp of, like, nobody else could have made this film except for me.
Mm-hmm.
But so in the beginning of the film, my body's being wrapped in plastic.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the sounds that the sound designer Nathan and I came up with were, like, we use growling sounds. We use sounds of being submerged underwater because of feet. Like, I was trying to have what I wanted to do was create an immersive experience
mm-hmm.
for the audience when they were watching, even if they're not sort of consciously aware of what was going on. But the feeling of when you're, like, binging and trying to stop and, like, you know, you can't stop is a feeling of claustrophobia and a feeling of just, like, drowning. And so sort of all of those things we found sound parallels for
mm-hmm.
and kind of put them into the sound design.
That also brings me to maybe one of the last things that we're going to talk about, the fact that it was hard for them to know when this movie was done. They weren't sure that it was done. Froud said, to be honest, when we finished it, we sort of thought, well, is that it? We'd always wanted to do our best, and we'd always wanted to break down some boundaries and do something different. When the film was finally finished and there was nothing else we could do to make it any better, we went, well, okay, did we do well? Because it was a different take. The Dark Crystal was definitely seriously out there strange, and this was much more whimsical. So what did we have? So at some point in time, they couldn't make it any
yeah.
better, and they didn't know if it was done. And this is a big budget movie. Like, there's a lot of work, a lot of technicians, a lot of art that went into this. And yet they still didn't know if it was done.
But, you know, the thing that I'm, like, what I'm hearing from that, though, is that they did all they could.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it's this weird thing of, like, it has to be done if you've done all you can.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what more can you do? Which is different from my experience and what I've read of a lot of directors is that, like, they could keep going, but they either have to stop because of time or because of budget. But they could really just keep going and mm-hmm. finding different elements. And I know I could have kept editing, definitely, for, like, another 2 months.
Mm.
But, you know. we stopped.
Money.
Yes.
Some cash register sound.
Uh-huh. Or I'm seeing Cardi B's video. Money. Oh. All I need is money. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's the filmmaker's anthem.
Exactly.
I want to thank you so much for coming on the show, Chaiko.
Thank you for having me.
And how can people find solace?
So
I mean, the movie. Not yeah.
With food and drugs and alcohol. No. If you go to solacefilm.com or follow me or Solace Film on Instagram, you'll always see when we are screening at festivals. And we are in the middle of distribution negotiation now, but I am told that it will be available May 9th.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. Horgan77 says this is a great podcast for film nerds, those who are film nerd adjacent, and regular folk. As a regular dude, I find it edifying to hear some ways in which the experiences of women filmmakers may affect their perspectives on both works they love and create. And then we've got Trans G from Australia says genre films, women in the industry, film analysis. You literally can't go wrong with this podcast. Every episode is a different yet always amazing discussion. Keep on slicing. Oh, thank you guys so much. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.